Linda Brown died last week at 76. You may not recognize her name, but you almost definitely know the court case that put her at the center of a national debate. Brown's father tried to enroll her in an all-white elementary school in 1954 and ended up suing the Topeka Board of Education. The ensuing legal battle was Brown versus the Board of Education. Its famous precedent is that separate but equal schools are unjust. But all these decades later, public schools in the South are still very much segregated, even though the segregation process itself has changed. I examined this phenomenon with Penn State University professor Erica Frankenberg, Belisa Urbina of the group Ser Familia, and Atlanta Journal-Constitution education columnist Maureen Downey.
So, Erica, let me start with, in 2014, more than one in three black students in the South, that's 35.8%, attended a school that was intensely racially segregated, meaning 90% of students were non-white. That is a 12.8% increase from 23% in 1980. Was that finding surprising to you in any way?
Well, I think that one of the things that's really important to think about with regard to that finding is that the South, historically, because of the efforts it made after Brown v. Board of Education, had that really low percentage of black students in these segregated minority schools. And so for several decades, actually, the South had the lowest percentage of black students in such schools. As a native of the region in other areas of the country, I like to make that point. Right. When we work together to make this happen through a variety of court orders and other political efforts, we brought about tremendous change. You know, most people like to think of segregation as a Southern issue, and actually black students were the most integrated. What's unfortunate is that in the last decade or two decades, we've seen an unraveling of the progress that was made. And so we have seen that increase for black students in the South. It's still lower than Latino students in the region for a variety of reasons, but it's concerning that the advantages the South had no longer exist.
And Maureen, what does your reporting tell you about this resegregation in Georgia?
Well, it's been happening for quite a while in the South, and what it mimics is residential segregation in the South. We now have very segregated neighborhoods, white folks living in one area, North Fulton, for example, and black residents in South Fulton, the same for DeKalb County. So what we have here is people who are choosing to live in certain areas, and the schools then follow. And the question that I've raised in my reporting is people are choosing to segregate in some respects by choice. And I've talked to both black and white parents who question the value of putting their kids on a bus and taking them across town to attend a school that is more diverse. So I think the challenge here is that I'm not sure parents are as committed to this ideal as they once were.
Yeah. Belisa, what are you finding in working with Latino families?
We have been working with Latino families for the last 17 years. And what I have seen, you know, in the last, I will have to say, 6-7 years, is that Latino students tend to be more concentrated in certain schools. So I have seen that resegregation, you know, I haven't think about theoretically, but what I see in my everyday work is that Latinos are more concentrated in specific schools.
Do Latino families see this as a problem?
Not necessarily. I don't think they see it as a problem unless, you know, you go to the fact that most of these schools have less opportunities for the students than other regular schools.
Yeah, that's interesting. So the education reporter, her name is Nicole Hannah Jones for the New York Times Magazine, writes, "The inequality we see, school segregation is both structural, systemic, but it is also upheld by individual choices," which cuts to the point you were just making, Maureen.
Yeah, I think that's a good point here, and I don't really know how to go to deal with that point, frankly, because, you know, you go out and you talk to parents, and they value diversity. It's not that they dismiss it, but they like their neighborhood schools, and they also simply feel like they're entitled to the school down the street from them. That's one reason why they, you know, move to Roswell, or why they move to Decatur, or why they move to, you know, certain neighborhoods in Gwinnett County. So it's very difficult politically to come in and say, yes, you live down the street from the school, and you think it's a great school, but we prefer that your kid go to a school school 3 miles down the road, and one of their major factors is increasing diversity. Yeah. That is not a good sales job for parents anymore.
Right. Erica, does this idea of this kind of segregation that's highlighted in your report, does it necessarily mean inequality in education when it comes to the quality of principals, technology, and so on and so forth?
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons that we've continued to study this issue. For example, we find in the South that the typical Black and Latino student is exposed or goes to school that's about two-thirds composed of students from low-income families. The typical white student goes to school that has 20% percentage point less low-income students. That matters for a variety of different reasons, including the exposure to educational opportunity that one of your guests already mentioned. Mm-hmm. And so the premise of the Brown decision was that segregated schools were inherently unequal for Black students. There was also something in the social science record that was submitted to the court that talked about how white students who were in segregated white schools in these areas that were challenged had this unfair sense of superiority. So there are a range of different ways of thinking about why integrated schools matter. And I think it's really important to think both about the harms of segregated schools, but also the benefits of integrated schools that students of all races, both Black and Latino students, but also white students, benefit from. And I think it's also important to because we've shifted the way we think about public schools, we've kind of gotten away from thinking about some of those benefits. We've translated schools to thinking about it as much more of a private good, that it's something that parents can buy in terms of where they buy a house. Of course, that overlooks the segregation in the housing market that still affect Black and Latino mm-hmm. affluent families even. But we think about it as a private good. It's what I want for my kid, instead of thinking about public schools as educating our community's children. And so when we shift in thinking about schools from this public good to more of a private good, it helps us in some ways to be comfortable and okay with the fact that we have segregation and that some students are going to schools that don't have the same kind of opportunities, which is profoundly against sort of what we believe public schools to be about originally.
So interesting. But Lisa, I'm wondering, with the families that you talk to and work with, do they see their schools where there is this high concentration of other Latinos from their neighborhood? Do they see those schools as being equal in terms of education, in terms of teachers, as predominantly white schools?
Not in all neighborhoods. You know, you have schools that have predominantly Latino students in some neighborhoods that you can see, and parents tell you that they are lacking the opportunities for the children. The sporting facilities are not as good. They don't have the same quality of teachers. They don't have the same opportunities for the kids. So they notice. They know.
Yeah. A bit more from the report now, Erica. It is clear that the region is now moving backward in terms of the progress it made in desegregating schools. In fact, some states have recently created overtly racist policy proposals and rhetoric that simply ignores the reality that the region's future depends on developing the talents of people who live there and are the fastest growing segment of the population. Now, what states are we talking about here that are engaging in racist policy proposals, Erica?
So certainly one of the states that we can think about is my native state of Alabama. In fact, in 2010 or 2011, they passed one of the most restrictive laws against immigration in the country that had a really damaging effect on the opportunity for Latino students who are scared even in some instances to go to school. Principals were reporting a drastic increase in absenteeism because of concerns about what was going to happen with their family. Also, some issues in terms of even schools requiring certain information from families that would have potentially revealed documentation status. All of these policies, many of these policies were blocked by the federal courts, so they're not in place. But even passing such laws, I think, sends a real chilling effect to families and communities that you're not welcome. And schools in particular, that goes against fundamentally the kind of trusting environment that you're trying to create to be welcoming to all families so that everyone is engaged collaboratively in the educational environment. So You know, that's certainly one example. We also know in many states in the South, and we talk about this in our report, that there are other policies that are really going to be challenging to integration moving forward. Certainly, there are places in the South that are creating these new school districts, like certainly the Gardendale case in metropolitan Birmingham has been a real flashpoint lately, the creation of that white enclave and the way in which that then creates district boundary lines that are going to impede desegregation
efforts.
These
are sort of breakaway communities, correct?
Exactly. Splinter. You can even call them, to some extent, seceding from a larger, more diverse school district because we typically don't let students cross boundary lines to go to school. That has a real huge impact in terms of the overall segregation we're seeing in our metropolitan areas across the country and is a growing issue in the South. There was just a recent report that said most of the new creation of school districts in this splinter-like format are occurring in the South. So that's a really big issue that is chipping away at another advantage the South had, which was having a lot of countywide districts that enabled more diversity because you had both communities of color and white communities in the same district and at least had different opportunities for student assignment that you don't have when they're in different school districts.
Maureen, do we see this? Do we see breakaway communities developing in Georgia?
Oh, we don't because our Constitution won't allow it, won't allow these new school districts. And that was, you know, essentially passed to prevent exactly what Erica described.
That was Penn State University Professor Erica Frankenberg. Melissa Urbina of Ser Familia and Atlanta Journal-Constitution education columnist Maureen Downey. It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris. Last summer, Wesleyan College students researching their Macon school's history made a pretty startling discovery. Wesleyan, like many others, has close historical ties to racism, slavery, and even the Ku Klux Klan. The discovery came just months after an incident involving racist graffiti on a dorm room wall. What can schools do to right century-old wrongs? The research was led by Wesleyan history professor Karen Huber, who joined me to discuss the archives. Also with us was Dana Amahir, a Wesleyan alumna. Dana, let me start with you. We're going to spend the first few minutes here sort of dissecting what you and Karen learned, what you uncovered. But take me back to 2006. You were, I believe, a freshman at Wesleyan.
Yes.
You're sleeping one night, and what wakes you up?
Well, what wakes me up is the sound of my dorm mates all herding to the auditorium on campus. When you walk in, it's dark. There are drums beating. There are girls chanting and screaming, and there are girls lined up on stage in purple robes with hoods. It's sort of just a surreal experience.
What did you make of it? How was it explained to you?
There wasn't a whole lot of explanation at the time. It was just sort of a little bit of a free-for-all. I started getting pieces of information over the next few days that it was a ritual of the college to bring together the first-year class. But from what I experienced, it had a very strange way of trying to bring everyone together.
Strange meaning what? What did you come to understand that ritual to be?
So the ritual is actually known as Lynx. It used to be known as Rats. Basically, the sophomore class takes it upon themselves to teach the underclassmen about the traditions of Wesleyan, teach us cheers and things, but it's done through a bit of scare tactics. It's the sophomore is trying to exert control over the freshman class in kind of mean ways, like just being very passive aggressive, wanting us to do things for them without question, that sort of thing.
Karen, let me come to you. How did your research project start?
Well, in 2015, I was teaching a public history class, and I asked the students what they were interested in doing. And this group of students was particularly interested in looking at the history of race at Wesleyan, and in particular, the history we didn't talk about. So there's a lot of talk about the first five African-American graduates who started at Wesleyan in 1968. They wanted to look at African-Americans at Wesleyan before the first five. So we started to do research on employees and even enslaved people who would have worked at the college or been enslaved by the college. And we tried to find evidence about that, and that eventually led us to looking at a much larger project that took in the long view of race and some really problematic history that we found from the college.
And Dana, look, I want to push you on this a little bit here. For more than a century, you came to realize that your school, the nation's oldest college, mm-hmm. chartered for women, had this historical linkage to the Klan. When did
yes.
that become clear for you?
That became clear for me actually working for the Office of Admissions, starting the end of my freshman year. And into the rest of my years at Wesleyan. One of the things that we were tasked with doing was giving campus tours to prospective students. And part of that was being able to answer their questions. So I had questions myself in order to be able to help them about the history of the school and things as simple as where our class names came from.
Yes.
So it was a little surprising to me to find out that our Red Pirate class, since every class has a name and a color, used to be called the Tri-K's, and immediately bells go off in my head that Tri-K's, I grew up in the South, I mean, it's Ku Klux Klan, this is not hard to put together, but it's something that's just not really talked about.
What was your emotional reaction to learning this?
I was stunned. I was really stunned, but at the same time, I was a little irritated that nobody really talked about this, that it was just sort of, it was something that I really had to push to get answers about.
Karen, how did this linkage come to be, this linkage between the college and the Klan? What does your research tell us?
Well, this was one of the key questions that I wanted to answer when I continued with the research that my students started. So I was commissioned by the college to actually figure this out this past year. And what I found was that in 1909, the first class graduated that claimed the KKK Ku Klux Klan name. And that group seems to have been inspired by a series of novels written by Thomas Dixon in 1902, 1905, and 1908 that were immediately turned into plays. The plays were played in Macon in 1905 and 1908 as The Klansman and The Traitor. And those plays inspired the 1915 film, The Birth of the Nation. So these are plays that very much romanticize and glorify the Ku Klux Klan, which at the time was in kind of a lull. And so it looks as though these women may have had relatives who were also Klan members from their earlier, more active years after the Civil War and through Reconstruction. But it looks as though these women came back from this fun play with 75 people on stage and two boxcars of scenery that was a major social event in Macon, and decided that this is what they wanted to model their class name after. And the really troubling part is that these women made this decision that was not changed until very late in the century.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're talking about a troubling racial past at Wesleyan College in Macon. Karen Huber is a history professor there, and Dana Amahir is a Wesleyan College alum. She's joining us from Dallas. Professor Huber, did the college at any point attempt to shut down this research?
No, they paid for it, in fact. So I know that I've heard since this research came out from students who felt like they in the past have not been given access. However, you know, it would be very bad if they denied access to a professional historian who's on the faculty. So my experience hasn't been one of denial, although I respect and want to acknowledge that there are students who have had a different experience of that.
Yeah.
So no, they haven't shut me down. They actually supported it. But, you know, it's late. We should have done this years ago. I think Dana's article that she wrote as a student in 2009, that might have been the first time I heard about this. But certainly there were people on campus who knew about it before that. And, you know, in my research, I've found evidence from 1948 when there was an article in the class newspaper where they talked about whether or not they ought to rename the class and whether or not KKK still stood for Ku Klux Klan. And they bring up the idea that, oh, well, maybe now it's about, let's see, what is it? Catherine's Campus Cuties, named after some professor. So they seem to think that you can just sort of erase it and make it stand for anything.
So your new president, Vivia Fowler, is quoted in the Atlanta Journal-Constitutional last month saying essentially what you just said. We probably should have done it 20 years ago, and the it is apologize. But we didn't. So we're doing it now. We can't ignore what happened in the past. Dana, why has it taken so long with all of this now documented history to apologize?
I wish I knew. I know that the resources that I had available to me when I was a student and when I was editor of the campus newspaper, all of this information lived in our archives, but no one ever decided to acknowledge that this material existed. Or that it tracked a less than perfect history of Wesleyan. Even when you start to ask questions, it was not exactly encouraged for you to go seek out these things. It was more of a, you know, they're there. That's not really something that we need to talk about. I think it's long overdue. It's so long overdue, and it's something that could have been easily addressed, I think, years and decades ago.
You have a thought on that, Karen?
Yeah, I agree with Dana. I actually, the process of watching my students in 2015 go through the archives and find this material and, you know, find evidence, you know, they found evidence of us hiring out a slave boy in 1861, an enslaved person who, you know, was hired out, which means that Wesleyan's faculty and Porter paid his master, not him, to work on the college. All of that was very empowering to the students as they did this research, and it would have been a great learning process to have had students go through much earlier. So I think that Dana's right, that there was this sense on campus of not wanting to talk about it, but we're late to the game, but now we want to talk about it, and we're going to make sure that happens.
Sure. And this is more of a statement from the Wesleyan administration. During the process, quoting now, during the process of uncovering and discussing our institution's past, we have learned of many things we still need to work on today. We are committed to inclusion, equality, and social justice for every member of the Wesleyan community. We hope that all members of our community will help us move forward with our goal of creating a community where all are able to know, trust, learn from, and care for one another. Our story is one of hope, where the lessons of history make us stronger, end quote. So Karen, what does moving forward look like?
Well, that's a good question, and that's actually my part of moving forward means listening and asking questions. So this is where I'd love to use your venue to say to any Wesleyan alums out there that I have two classes who are getting trained on how to conduct oral history interviews, and we would love to collect the stories from Wesleyans of all ages who have stories to tell us either about race or just their experience in general. And we'd love to hear from them to get a more complete picture. We only have the picture of the documents that are in our archives right now, and we want to hear from everybody. So that's part of it, is just listening. But I think we also need to take a really hard look at the privilege that those of us who are white and middle class and educated have.
That was Wesleyan history professor Karen Huber and Dana Amahir, a Wesleyan alumna. Girls 8 to 18 on quad roller skates race around rinks and hone the art of jamming, blocking, and scoring. It's Flat Track Derby. On Second Thought, intern Emily Bunker visited the Atlanta Junior Roller Derby to see what this quirky sport is all about.
My real name is Tui Bratton, and my skate name is Category. There's the pack, four from each team, and those are blockers in the pack. And then there's a jammer, one from each team. And the jammers are trying to make their way through the pack legally so that you can hit and things, but there are rules. And when the jammer passes blockers, each blocker's hips they pass is a point. I started roller derby when I was 6 years old, and I am 13. Because I remember when I was little, I mean, vaguely remember, it was just really hard and I didn't know what I was doing. In roller derby, you see something and you think, that's really hard, how am I going to do that? But then you do it.
My name is Michelle Williams, and I'm from Connecticut, Greenwich, Connecticut. My daughter is, she's new to rec. The very first time, I was a little nervous because she was my baby and she was young. But then once I saw her and how aggressive she was, which I never saw that side of her, I was like, oh, okay, I'm fine. I say just throw yourself into it. It's awesome to watch. And it empowers females. Like, I don't know, I just sit through the whole bout, like, smiling, because I'm like, these girls are tough. They, you know, have on their makeup, they have on their cute little, you know, whatever, their skirts or shorts, and but they are tough, and I love it.
Mattitude Adjustment, the head coach of Atlanta Junior Roller Derby. My actual name is Madeline. To see every day that there's something changing, whether they're just getting stronger themselves or they're working better with their teammates or they're taking a footwork thing and putting it into a practice. The leaps and bounds they've made has been amazing, and I always tell them it makes my little coach heart so happy.
My name's Alexis Robinson, but I go by Chipper, and I'm from Decatur. I got the nickname Chip in fifth grade because pretty much all I eat is chips. And when I started playing roller derby, we had to transfer that and kind of make it tough. So Chip Her holds true. My hips are apparently very bony. Girls quit sports at a young age because of social stigmas, but in roller derby, there's none of that. I mean, whoever you are, you're loved, you're accepted, and we just don't have time for hate.
I'm Violet Lorish, and I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, and my roller derby name is Violet Femmes. I'm 12. I'm on the Voodoo Dollies, and the other team is the Glitter Mafia. I wanted to play football. This was safer, probably, but you still get to legally hit people. Not in a bad way.
My name is Sean Green. I live in Midtown Atlanta. I remember when it clicked for my oldest. She's a blocker. She stopped everybody. It was incredible. My middle kid does it too, and my little six-year-old is tooling around here somewhere waiting for the opportunity to turn eight.
It's just skating and gliding on floors.
Your name's Gretchen, and your nickname's Gigi, and we've been calling you
Gigi Normus.
It's an amazingly open and welcoming group of people. Young girls ages 8 to 18, if soccer hasn't worked, if football hasn't worked, if hockey hasn't worked, you should try roller derby anyways. It's a ton of fun.
Special thanks to On Second Thought intern Emily Bunker for producing this postcard. With no serious damage, we should add, to toes or fingers. From its earliest days as a nation, the United States has struggled with a problem we can't seem to solve: racism. It's the foundation of many policies that formed and divided the country. Ibram Kendi chronicled the evolution of racism in his book, Stamped from the Beginning: The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. It won the 2016 National Book Award for Nonfiction. That year, he spoke with my colleague, Celeste Headley. Here's their conversation.
It's very difficult to read a book these days on racism that says new things, but you seem to do it all the way through the whole book. And let's start with the first, the most essential thing, which is your use of racial ideas instead of saying it's a history of racism. What's the difference?
Well, I wanted to distinguish between the ideology of racism. So somebody thinking, for instance, that Black people are lazy, and the praxis of racism, or the practice which is somebody discriminating, let's say, against a Black worker. And I wanted to sort of show the development of these ideas over the course of American history and the way they interacted with these policies and with these forms of discrimination. And so people can sort of see how their own ideas have impacted their behavior or vice versa.
It's not a, a comfortable book, though, if you are going to find, let's say that you're an, a liberal-minded African-American and you are going to this book to see all of your ideas about racism confirmed, you won't find comfort here because you're not just talking about white racism in this book. You also take on racial ideas held by people of color. Why do that? Do you feel as though it's necessary to include everybody?
Well, I did it because it's part of the history. And, you know, as a scholar, as an historian, I wanted to tell the complete story. And ideas are ideas. And so anybody can hold ideas that Black people are criminals, that we should fear Black people. And even Black people hold those ideas, even though there's no evidence that supports it. And so I wanted to chronicle, so everyone who believes that there's something wrong with Black people could recognize that those ideas are not only racist ideas, but those ideas are false.
Let's examine at least one of those sort of category of racist ideas among African Americans. And you talk in there about the civil rights movement and this idea that if whites see Blacks uplifting themselves, it'll improve the overall opinion of the race. The idea of the good Black, right? That you see as a racist idea that was held by a lot of African Americans during the 1960s and 70s. Why did that idea arise and why did it take hold?
Well, white abolitionists in the 1790s started seeing the emergence of free Blacks, and they basically started lecturing those free Blacks that if they uplift themselves and defy stereotypes, then they will persuade away the racist ideas of whites. And a certain segment of Black America took hold of that strategy and has passed it on till this day. The reason why it's a racist idea is very simple. Because it suggests that Black people are responsible for the racist ideas that white people have about them. And to suggest that Black people are responsible for the racist ideas whites have is to suggest that there's some truth in notions of Black inferiority. And to believe there's some truth in notions of Black inferiority is to hold racist ideas.
So what is the difference then? And I ask you all these questions. The book answers them all and answers them really readably. But what is the difference between a racial idea and discrimination?
So, you know, going back to the initial example, if I, as a small business owner, have a job opening and a Black person comes in to apply, and I think that that Black person is lazy merely because of the color of their skin, that's a racist idea. But then let's say that person applies and I hire them because I don't want to be sued. I'm not engaging in a racist practice, but other business owners may decide not to hire that person because of the color of their skin. That's a racist policy or that's racial discrimination.
Okay, so let's go back then to what drove you to write this book. And I want to play you a comment. One of our producers went to the National Center for Civil and Human Rights here in Atlanta and asked people who were there on their thoughts on racism. So here is one Atlanta resident who blames technology for it.
My name is Saida Ogbemudia. I'm 24 years old. To me, racism is, it's not growing. It's always been there, and it's just being more and more exposed with the addition of social media. And I mean, just read the YouTube section. I mean, the comments in the YouTube section, it's more and more people. They're coming out of the woodworks because they feel more bold with technology.
And you write in your preface, I think it was, that you were driven to write this book because of all of the killings, the police-involved shootings and killings. Here she is saying that it sounds like what she's saying is that racism is as bad as it ever has ever been. We're just seeing more of it. What do you make of that?
So, you know, that's something that I had to think about as I was writing this history. And I came to realize that there has been racial progress over the course of American history. but there's been a simultaneous progression of racism. And I chronicled both. And so American history has both histories happening simultaneously.
Then let's hear one more comment that was gathered during the at the National Center for Civil and Human Rights. This is Nia Daniel, who is an Atlanta-based filmmaker. And here she is with her thoughts of, the origins.
When you look at the term race, it denotes a competition. And so when you're born and you're put in a particular race, that automatically puts you in on a team that has to win. So we're automatically pitted against one another. So I feel like if we're going to like wipe out racism, we have to wipe out the term race. We're a people. We're not just different races trying to compete to win.
And you actually start tracing the history of racial ideas in America back to Europe. And what do we know about the very beginnings of racist ideas?
So, yeah, the beginning of racist ideas was in 15th century Portugal. The Portuguese were the first nation, European nation to start exclusively slave trading in African people. And because they started exclusively slave trading in African people, they needed a justification, specifically before the Pope. And that justification became racist ideas. These people were beasts, these people were uncivil, and we're going to civilize them.
And then as you're walking through your book, you have separated it with tour guides. You focused on certain people, Cotton Mather, Thomas Jefferson, William Lloyd Garrison, W.E.B. Du Bois, and then finally Angela Davis to sort of walk us through this history. And why do we begin with Cotton Mather?
Well, first and foremost, Cotton Mather was the most influential theologian and preacher in early America, or I should say colonial America. He was a pastor at the North Church, which was the most prestigious church in New England. And first and foremost, he was a theologian, and science was theology, and theology was science in the 1600s and early 1700s. And so first, you know, he was at the forefront of scientific ideas as a theologian. And then secondly, he was in the midst of this debate over whether Black people could become Christian. And so you had slave owners saying that no, they were too beasts, they were too barbaric to become Christians. And then you had preachers like Cotton Mather saying no, they actually can become Christians. But the way he went about it was to say that though our bodies may be unequal, in other words, Black bodies are unequal and should be enslaved, our souls are equal. And that if Black people become Christians, their souls will become white.
And then what does that mean? Because, I mean, imagine that people are looking would look down the table of contents in your book and say, wait, where's Frederick Douglass? Where's Martin Luther King Jr.? Why does Cotton Mather then become, that idea, then become pivotal?
Well, he was in the midst of the pivotal debate, right? And that debate over whether Black people could become Christian. And so that was a very pivotal debate during his time period. And it really created this division between racist ideas. One group saying that Black people were permanently inferior and could not become human, because to become human was to become Christian. And then there were Cotton Mather who were saying, no, they can become, you know, they are inferior right now, but they have the capacity to rise and become civilized. And, you know, later in the book, I do talk about Frederick Douglass and his racist ideas. I do talk about King, when he suggested that God is white. And so, you know, but during Cotton Mather's time period, you know, he was this pivotal force in the debate between racist ideas.
We're speaking with Ibram Kendi. He's author of the book Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. Now, Cotton Mather, that idea of whether or not African-Americans could become Christian leads us almost directly to Thomas Jefferson and the founding of the country. So what is built into, I guess, our founding documents that relates to racist ideas? How did that become part of our very creation?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, of course, you had many of the writers of the founding documents were slave owners. And many of the slave owners in America, in colonial America, and then ultimately the United States, were defending slavery through racist ideas, saying that Black people should be enslaved because they're so uncivilized or because they were cursed they're descendants of Ham and they were cursed, or whatever idea that suggested that they should be enslaved. But then the actual Constitution itself, of course, many people are familiar with the three-fifths clause in which, for population purposes, enslaved Africans could be part of the population in the South. But the way that sort of operated was you had one group of people that stated that Black people were permanently three-fifths in terms of inferior to those five-fifths white humans. And then you had another group that would say that, yes, Black people are three-fifths right now, but we have the capacity to civilize them. And that was really the heart of the debate, and that has been the heart of the debate about racist ideas throughout the course of American history.
So I want to play you a comment from Kathleen Cleaver, who's now a lecturer at Emory University, but she was a member of the original Black Panther Party. And what she's talking about is, yes, how much progress has been made, but also how slow it has gone. Take a listen.
We attracted a lot of very, very intense people to fight for our freedom. The 14th Amendment was passed at the end of the Civil War and gave Black people the right to vote. In the 60s, we're having a voting rights movement, okay? So America is very slow about recognizing what Blacks are entitled to, and particularly in the South, they want to undo and unroll and push back.
So this is one of the threads throughout your book is the slow progress. Why is it so slow? What holds back the fight against racist ideas?
Well, because racist ideas, or I should say racist policies, benefit people. And so racist ideas, I show, have long been put to use to defend racist policies.
That was Ibram Kendi, author of Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. He spoke with my colleague, Celeste Headley. Last year, when South Fulton became a separate city from Atlanta, Councilman Khalid Kamau claimed that Atlanta media were biased against the majority Black community. We think his thoughts are still pertinent.
On Tuesday, April 18, 2017, residents of South Fulton elected a mayor and city council. Georgia's newest municipality, South Fulton, is also the state's largest in 100 years. Over 100,000 people and 107 square miles, just 25 square miles smaller than our state's capital. In just 5 months, through a special election and a runoff, residents sifted through over 70 candidates to select its 7 council members and mayor. You may have missed this event entirely if you do not subscribe to the South Fulton Neighbor or some social media group that follows South Fulton. With the exception of 11 Alive's news story on my campaign, the result of me badgering every reporter in my phone book, local television news did not report the new city of South Fulton, did not report on any of the elections or debates or candidates running, declined invitations to over 30 town halls and forums held in the last 3 months of the election alone. Yet, when a toddler was shot in a drive-by shooting in a South Fulton's Pointer Ridge subdivision, just 2 nights after our election, reporters from WSB2, CBS 46, and Fox 5 all came out and stayed for hours covering the story. Anyone watching local news would think South Fulton suffered the highest crime rate in Atlanta, and they'd be wrong. That distinction belongs to Buckhead. However, like the South Side of many American cities, the percentage of Black and brown residents in Atlanta's South Side, in South Fulton, is far higher than Atlanta's North Side or the producing staff of any of Atlanta's newsrooms. The implicit bias of those who produce news stories about African Americans is a well-documented fact. This stereotyping does more than hurt our feelings. It hurts our property values. It hurts our ability to attract employers, new residents, and entertainment venues. The new city of South Fulton is a historic event and a newsworthy one, as evidenced by national coverage from The Nation, The Guardian, and The Huffington Post. If Atlanta's major news outlets cannot learn to paint a full picture of South Fulton's humanity, we will be forced to teach them by creating media outlets of our own and boycotting those only interested in showing us at our worst.
That's South Fulton City Councilman Khalid Kamau.